He takes up a most interesting position, continued the father librarian. As far as church jurisdiction is concerned, he is apparently quite opposed to the separation of church from state. That's interesting. But in what sense? Father Zossima asked Ivan. The latter, at last, answered him, not condescendingly, as Alishaw had feared, but with modesty and reserve, with evident goodwill and apparently without the slightest irrepensy. I start from the position that this confusion of elements, that is, of the essential principles of church and state, will, of course, go on forever, in spite of the fact that it is impossible for them to mingle, and that the confusion of these elements cannot lead to any consistent or even normal results, for there is falsity at the very foundation of it. Compromise between the church and state in such questions as, for instance, jurisdiction, is, to my thinking, impossible in any real sense. My clerical opponent maintains that the church holds a precise and defined position in the state. I maintain, on the contrary, that the church ought to include the whole state, and not simply to occupy a corner in it, and, if this is, for some reason, impossible at present, then it ought, in reality, to be set up as the direct and chief aim of the future development of Christian society. Perfectly true, Father Pacey, the silent and learned monk, assented with fervor and decision. The purest ultramontanism, cried Musoff impatiently, crossing and recrossing his legs. Oh, well, we have no mountains, cried Father Iosif, and turning to the elder he continued, observe the answer he makes to the following fundamental and essential propositions of his opponent, who is, you must note, an ecclesiastic. First, that no social organization can or ought to arrogate to itself power to dispose of the civic and political rights of its members. Secondly, that criminal and civil jurisdiction ought not to belong to the church, and is inconsistent with its nature, both as a divine institution and as an organization of men for religious objects. And, finally, in the third place, the church is a kingdom not of this world. A most unworthy play upon words for an ecclesiastic. Father Pacey could not refrain from breaking in again. I have read the book which you have answered, he added, addressing Ivan, and was astounded at the words "the church is a kingdom not of this world." If it is not of this world, then it cannot exist on earth at all. In the Gospel, the words "not of this world" are not used in that sense. To play with such words is indefensible. Our Lord Jesus Christ came to set up the church upon earth. The kingdom of heaven, of course, is not of this world, but in heaven, but it is only entered through the church which has been founded and established upon earth. And so a frivolous play upon words in such a connection is unpardonable and improper. The church is, in truth, a kingdom and ordained to rule, and in the end must undoubtedly become the kingdom ruling over all the earth. For that we have the divine promise. He ceased speaking suddenly, as though checking himself. After listening attentively and respectfully, Ivan went on, addressing the elder with perfect composure and as before with ready cordiality, the whole point of my article lies in the fact that during the first 3 centuries Christianity only existed on earth in the church and was nothing but the church. When the pagan Roman Empire desired to become Christian, it inevitably happened that, by becoming Christian, it included the church but remained a pagan state in very many of its departments. In reality, this was bound to happen. But Rome as a state retained too much of the pagan civilization and culture, as, for example, in the very objects and fundamental principles of the state. The Christian church entering into the state could, of course, surrender no part of its fundamental principles, the rock on which it stands, and could pursue no other aims than those which have been ordained and revealed by God Himself, and among them that of drawing the whole world, and therefore the ancient pagan state itself, into the church. In that way, that is, with a view to the future, it is not the church that should seek a definite position in the state, like every social organization, or as an organization of men for religious purposes, as my opponent calls the church. But, on the contrary, every earthly state should be, in the end, completely transformed into the church and should become nothing else but a church, rejecting every purpose incongruous with the aims of the church. All this will not degrade it in any way or take from its honor and glory as a great state, nor from the glory of its rulers, but only turns it from a false, still pagan, and mistaken path to the true and rightful path, which alone leads to the eternal goal. This is why the author of the book on the foundations of church jurisdiction would have judged correctly if, in seeking and laying down those foundations, he bad looked upon them as a temporary compromise inevitable in our sinful and imperfect days. But as soon as the author ventures to declare that the foundations which he predicates now, part of which Father Iosif just enumerated, are the permanent, essential, and eternal foundations, he is going directly against the church and its sacred and eternal vocation. That is the gist of my article. That is, in brief, Father Pacey began again, laying stress on each word, according to certain theories only too clearly formulated in the 19th century. The church ought to be transformed into the state, as though this would be an advance from a lower to a higher form, so as to disappear into it, making way for science, for the spirit of the age, and civilization. And if the church resists and is unwilling, some corner will be set apart for her in the state, and even that under control, and this will be so everywhere in all modern European countries. But Russian hopes and conceptions demand not that the church should pass us from a lower into a higher type into the state, but, on the contrary, that the state should end by being worthy to become only the church and nothing else. So be it. So be it. Well, I confess you've reassured me somewhat, Musov said smiling, again crossing his legs. So far as I understand, then, the realization of such an ideal is infinitely remote, at the second coming of Christ. That's as you please. It's a beautiful utopian dream of the abolition of war, diplomacy, banks, and so on, something after the fashion of socialism, indeed. But I imagined that it was all meant seriously, and that the church might be now going to try criminals, and sentence them to beating, prison, and even death. But if there were none but the ecclesiastical court, the church would not even now sentence a criminal to prison or to death. Crime and the way of regarding it would inevitably change, not all at once of course, but fairly soon, Ivan replied calmly, without flinching. Are you serious? Musov glanced keenly at him. If everything became the church would exclude all the criminal and disobedient, and would not cut off their heads, Ivan went on. I ask you, what would become of the excluded? He would be cut off then not only from men, as now, but from Christ. By his crime he would have transgressed not only against men but against the Church of Christ. This is so even now, of course, strictly speaking, but it is not clearly enunciated, and very, very often the criminal of today compromises with his conscience. I steal, he says, but I don't go against the church. I'm not an enemy of Christ. That's what the criminal of today is continually saying to himself. But when the church takes the place of the state, it will be difficult for him, in opposition to the church all over the world, to say, all men are mistaken, all in error, all mankind are the false church. I, a thief and murderer, am the only true Christian church. It will be very difficult to say this to himself. It requires a rare combination of unusual circumstances. Now, on the other side, take the church's own view of crime. Is it not bound to renounce the present almost pagan attitude, and to change from a mechanical cutting off of its tainted member for the preservation of society, as at present, into completely and honestly adopting the idea of the regeneration of the man, of his reformation and salvation? What do you mean? I failed to understand again, Musov interrupted. Some sort of dream again. Something shapeless and even incomprehensible. What is excommunication? What sort of exclusion? I suspect you are simply amusing yourself, Ivan Fyodorovich. Yes, but you know, in reality it is so now, said the elder suddenly, and all turned to him at once. If it were not for the Church of Christ, there would be nothing to restrain the criminal from evil, doing, no real chastisement for it afterwards, none, that is, but the mechanical punishment spoken of just now, which in the majority of cases only embitters the heart, and not the real punishment. The only effectual one, the only deterrent and softening one, which lies in the recognition of sin by conscience. How is that, may one inquire? Asked Musov, with lively curiosity. And #2018:y, began the elder, all these sentences to exile with hard labor, and formerly with flogging also, reform no one, and what's more, deter hardly a single criminal, and the number of crimes does not diminish but is continually on the increase. You must admit that. Consequently, the security of society is not preserved, for, although the obnoxious member is mechanically cut off and sent far away out of sight, another criminal always comes to take his place at once, and often two of them. If anything does preserve society, even in our time, and does regenerate and transform the criminal, it is only the law of Christ speaking in his conscience. It is only by recognizing his wrongdoing as a son of a Christian society, that is, of the Church, that he recognizes his sin against society, that is, against the Church. So that it is only against the Church, and not against the state, that the criminal of today can recognize that he has sinned. If society, as a Church, had jurisdiction, then it would know when to bring back from exclusion and to reunite to itself. Now the Church having no real jurisdiction, but only the power of moral condemnation, withdraws of her own accord from punishing the criminal actively. She does not excommunicate him but simply persists in motherly exhortation of him. What is more, the Church even tries to preserve all Christian communion with the criminal. She admits him to church services, to the Holy Sacrament, gives him alms, and treats him more a captive than as a convict. And what would become of the criminal, O Lord, if even the Christian society, that is, the Church, were to reject him even as the civil law rejects him and cuts him off? What would become of him if the Church punished him with her excommunication as the direct consequence of the secular law? There could be no more terrible despair, at least for a Russian criminal, for Russian criminals still have faith. Though, who knows, perhaps then a fearful thing would happen. Perhaps the despairing heart of the criminal would lose its faith and then what would become of him? But the Church, like a tender, loving mother, holds aloof from active punishment herself, as the sinner is too severely punished already by the civil law, and there must be at least someone to have pity on him. The Church holds aloof, above all, because its judgment is the only one that contains the truth, and therefore cannot practically and morally be united to any other judgment even as a temporary compromise. She can enter into no compact about that. The foreign criminal, they say, rarely repents, for the very doctrines of today confirm him in the idea that his crime is not a crime, but only a reaction against an unjustly oppressive force. Society cuts him off completely by a force that triumphs over him mechanically and, so at least they say of themselves in Europe, accompanies this exclusion with hatred, forgetfulness, and the most profound indifference as to the ultimate fate of the erring brother. In this way, it all takes place without the compassionate intervention of the Church, for in many cases there are no churches there at all, for though ecclesiastics and splendid church buildings remain, the churches themselves have long ago striven to pass from church into state and to disappear in it completely. So it seems at least in Lutheran countries. As for Rome, it was proclaimed a state instead of a church 1,000 years ago. And so the criminal is no longer conscious of being a member of the Church and sinks into despair. If he returns to society, often it is with such hatred that society itself instinctively cuts him off. You can judge for yourself how it must end. In many cases it would seem to be the same with us, but the difference is that besides the established law courts we have the Church too, which always keeps up relations with the criminal as a dear and still precious son. And besides that, there is still preserved, though only in thought, the judgment of the Church, which though no longer existing in practice is still living as a dream for the future, and is, no doubt, instinctively recognized by the criminal in his soul. What was said here just now is true too, that is, that if the jurisdiction of the church were introduced in practice in its full force, that is, if the whole of the society were changed into the church, not only the judgment of the church would have influence on the reformation of the criminal such as it never has now, but possibly also the crimes themselves would be incredibly diminished. And there can be no doubt that the church would look upon the criminal and the crime of the future in many cases quite differently and would succeed in restoring the excluded, in restraining those who plan evil, and in regenerating the fallen. It is true, said Father Zossima, with a smile, the Christian society now is not ready and is only resting on some seven righteous men, but as they are never lacking, it will continue still unshaken in expectation of its complete transformation from a society almost heathen in character into a single universal and all-powerful church. So be it, so be it. Even though at the end of the ages, for it is ordained to come to pass. And there is no need to be troubled about times and seasons, for the secret of the times and seasons is in the wisdom of God, in His foresight, and His love. And what in human reckoning seems still afar off, may by the divine ordinance be close at hand, on the eve of its appearance. And so be it, so be it. So be it, so be it. Father Pacey repeated austerely and reverently. Strange, extremely strange, Musoffa pronounced, not so much with heat as with latent indignation. What strikes you as so strange? Father Iosif inquired cautiously. Why, it's beyond anything! Cried Musoff, suddenly breaking out, the state is eliminated and the church is raised to the position of the state. It's not simply Ultramontanism, it's Arch-Ultramontanism. It's beyond the dreams of Pope Gregory the VII. You are completely misunderstanding it, said Father Pacey sternly. Understand. The church is not to be transformed into the state. That is Rome and its dream. That is the third temptation of the devil. On the contrary, the state is transformed into the church, will ascend and become a church over the whole world, which is the complete opposite of Ultramontanism and Rome, and your interpretation, and is only the glorious destiny ordained for the Orthodox Church. This star will arise in the east. Musoff was significantly silent. His whole figure expressed extraordinary personal dignity. A supercilious and condescending smile played on his lips. Alishaw watched it all with a throbbing heart. The whole conversation stirred him profoundly. He glanced casually at Rakitin, who was standing immovable in his place by the door listening and watching intently though with downcast eyes. But from the color in his cheeks Alishaw guessed that Rakitin was probably no less excited, and he knew what caused his excitement. Allow me to tell you one little anecdote, gentlemen, Musoff said impressively, with a peculiarly majestic air. Some years ago, soon after the coup d'état of December, I happened to be calling in Paris on an extremely influential personage in the government, and I met a very interesting man in his house. This individual was not precisely a detective but was a sort of superintendent of a whole regiment of political detectives. A rather powerful position in its own way. I was prompted by curiosity to seize the opportunity of conversation with him. And as he had not come as a visitor but as a subordinate official bringing a special report, and as he saw the reception given me by his chief, he deigned to speak with some openness, to a certain extent only, of course. He was rather courteous than open, as Frenchmen know how to be courteous, especially to a foreigner. But I thoroughly understood him. The subject was the socialist revolutionaries who were at that time persecuted. I will quote only one most curious remark dropped by this person. We are not particularly afraid, said he, of all these socialists, anarchists, infidels, and revolutionists. We keep watch on them and know all their goings on. But there are a few peculiar men among them who believe in God and are Christians, but at the same time are socialists. These are the people we are most afraid of. They are dreadful people. The socialist who is a Christian is more to be dreaded than a socialist who is an atheist. The words struck me at the time, and now they have suddenly come back to me here, gentlemen. You apply them to us, and look upon us as socialists? Father Pacey asked directly, without beating about the bush. But before Pyotr Alexandrovich could think what to answer, the door opened, and the guest so long expected, Dmitri Fyodorovich, came in. They had, in fact, given up expecting him, and his sudden appearance caused some surprise for a moment. Chapter 6. Why is such a man alive? Dmitri Fyodorovich, a young man of 28, of medium height and agreeable countenance, looked older than his years. He was muscular, and showed signs of considerable physical strength. Yet there was something not healthy in his face. It was rather thin, his cheeks were hollow, and there was an unhealthy sallowness in their color. His rather large, prominent, dark eyes had an expression of firm determination, and yet there was a vague look in them, too. Even when he was excited and talking irritably, his eyes somehow did not follow his mood, but betrayed something else, sometimes quite incongruous with what was passing. It's hard to tell what he's thinking, those who talked to him sometimes declared. People who saw something pensive and sullen in his eyes were startled by his sudden laugh, which bore witness to mirthful and light-hearted thoughts at the very time when his eyes were so gloomy. A certain strained look in his face was easy to understand at this moment. Everyone knew, or had heard of, the extremely restless and dissipated life which he had been leading of late, as well as of the violent anger to which he had been roused in his quarrels with his father. There were several stories current in the town about it. It is true that he was irascible by nature, of an unstable and unbalanced mind, as our Justice of the Peace, Kachelnikov, happily described him. He was stylishly and irreproachably dressed in a carefully buttoned frock coat. He wore black gloves and carried a top hat. Having only lately left the army, he still had moustaches and no beard. His dark brown hair was cropped short, and combed forward on his temples. He had the long, determined stride of a military man. He stood still for a moment on the threshold, and glancing at the whole party went straight up to the elder, guessing him to be their host. He made him a low bow, and asked his blessing. Father Zossima, rising in his chair, blessed him. Dmitri kissed his hand respectfully, and with intense feeling, almost anger, he said, "Be so generous as to forgive me for having kept you waiting so long, but Smerdyakov, the valet sent me by my father, in reply to my inquiries, told me twice over that the appointment was for one. Now I suddenly learn." "Don't disturb yourself," interposed the elder. "No matter. You are a little late. It's of no consequence. I'm extremely obliged to you, and expected no less from your goodness." Saying this, Dmitri bowed once more. Then, turning suddenly towards his father, made him, too, a similarly low and respectful bow. He had evidently considered it beforehand, and made this bow in all seriousness, thinking it his duty to show his respect and good intentions. Although Fyodor Pavlovich was taken unawares, he was equal to the occasion. In response to Dmitri's bow, he jumped up from his chair and made his son a bow as low in return. His face was suddenly solemn and impressive, which gave him a positively malignant look. Dmitri bowed generally to all present, and without a word walked to the window with his long, resolute stride, sat down on the only empty chair, near Father Pacey, and, bending forward, prepared to listen to the conversation he had interrupted. Dmitri's entrance had taken no more than 2 minutes, and the conversation was resumed. But this time Musov thought it unnecessary to reply to Father Pacey's persistent and almost irritable question. "Allow me to withdraw from this discussion," he observed with a certain well-bred nonchalance. "It's a subtle question, too. Here Ivan Fyodorovich is smiling at us. He must have something interesting to say about that also. Ask him." "Nothing special, except one little remark," Ivan replied at once. "European liberals in general, and even our liberal dilettanti, often mix up the final results of socialism with those of Christianity. This wild notion is, of course, a characteristic feature. But it's not only liberals and dilettanti who mix up socialism and Christianity, but, in many cases, it appears, the police, the foreign police, of course, do the same. Your Paris anecdote is rather to the point, Pyotr Alexandrovich. I ask your permission to drop this subject altogether, Musov repeated. I will tell you instead, gentlemen, another interesting and rather characteristic anecdote of Ivan Fyodorovich himself. Only 5 days ago, in a gathering here, principally of ladies, he solemnly declared in argument that there was nothing in the whole world to make men love their neighbors. That there was no law of nature that man should love mankind, and that, if there had been any love on earth hitherto, it was not owing to a natural law, but simply because men have believed in immortality. Ivan Fyodorovich added in parenthesis that the whole natural law lies in that faith, and that if you were to destroy in mankind the belief in immortality, not only love but every living force maintaining the life of the world would at once be dried up. Moreover, nothing then would be immoral, everything would be lawful, even cannibalism. That's not all. He ended by asserting that for every individual, like ourselves, who does not believe in God or immortality, the moral law of nature must immediately be changed into the exact contrary of the former religious law, and that egoism, even to crime, must become not only lawful but even recognized as the inevitable, the most rational, even honorable outcome of his position. From this paradox, gentlemen, you can judge of the rest of our eccentric and paradoxical friend Ivan Fyodorovich's theories. Excuse me, Dmitri cried suddenly, if I've heard aright, crime must not only be permitted but even recognized as the inevitable and the most rational outcome of his position for every infidel. Is that so or not? Quite so, said Father Pacey. I'll remember it. Having uttered these words, Dmitri ceased speaking as suddenly as he had begun. Everyone looked at him with curiosity. Is that really your conviction as to the consequences of the disappearance of the faith in immortality? The elder asked Ivan suddenly. Yes. That was my contention. There is no virtue if there is no immortality. You are blessed in believing that, or else most unhappy. Why unhappy? Ivan asked, smiling. Because, in all probability, you don't believe yourself in the immortality of your soul, nor in what you have written yourself in your article on church jurisdiction. Perhaps you are right. But I wasn't altogether joking, Ivan suddenly and strangely confessed, flushing quickly. You were not altogether joking. That's true. The question is still fretting your heart, and not answered. But the martyr likes sometimes to divert himself with his despair, as it were driven to it by despair itself. Meanwhile, in your despair, you, too, divert yourself with magazine articles, and discussions in society, though you don't believe your own arguments, and with an aching heart mock at them inwardly. That question you have not answered, and it is your great grief, for it clamors for an answer. But can it be answered by me? Answered in the affirmative? Ivan went on asking strangely, still looking at the elder with the same inexplicable smile. If it can't be decided in the affirmative, it will never be decided in the negative. You know that that is the peculiarity of your heart, and all its suffering is due to it. But thank the Creator who has given you a lofty heart capable of such suffering, of thinking and seeking higher things, for our dwelling is in the heavens. God grant that your heart will attain the answer on earth, and may God bless your path. The elder raised his hand and would have made the sign of the cross over Ivan from where he stood. But the latter rose from his seat, went up to him, received his blessing, and kissing his hand went back to his place in silence. His face looked firm and earnest. This action and all the preceding conversation, which was so surprising from Ivan, impressed everyone by its strangeness and a certain solemnity, so that all were silent for a moment, and there was a look almost of apprehension in Alyosha's face. But Musov suddenly shrugged his shoulders. And at the same moment Fyodor Pavlovich jumped up from his seat. Most pious and holy elder, he cried pointing to Ivan, that is my son, flesh of my flesh, the dearest of my flesh,